We have often said that curating a space museum has to be one of the best jobs in the world, but what exactly does that job involve?
Well, we spoke to three people who may be able to answer that question. So today, we're going to share the rest of those interviews that we got in January.
What would you like in your ideal space museum? Let us know via our social media pages at Space and Things Podcast on Threads, Instagram, and Facebook, or via the contact form on our website.
And please consider joining us over at patreon.com/spaceandthings. But right now, it's time for episode 185 of the Space and Things Podcast.
You're listening to Space and Things with Emily Carney and Dave Giles.
I'm Emily Carney.
And I'm Dave Giles, and welcome to episode 185 of our podcast. How you doing, Emily?
I'm doing good. Just came back from another trip to Epcot. Don't worry, I have a Florida residence thing, so it's not like I'm going into too much debt. But still, yeah, I went to Epcot, and it was awesome. So other than that, I'm also doing good. I'm hanging in there. How you doing, Dave?
Yeah, not too bad. Lots going on right now.
Oh, yeah.
But all good. All good. So regular listeners will know that in January, we went to Washington, D.C., and we have had three episodes since then, which were recorded while we were there. We interviewed three of the curators as part of the Space History Department. And if you haven't, you can already go and listen to the first parts of those interviews on episodes 179, 181, and 183. We said during those episodes that there was some extra stuff, and there is, and today you'll hear it.
A museum curator is someone who manages collections of objects or artistic, scientific, historical, and general interest items. At the Smithsonian, there is also a huge research element to the job, and they have huge archives at their disposal to do just that. Most curators at the Smithsonian have published works about their specific areas of interest, so they really are experts in their field.
The Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in downtown Washington, D.C. opened in 1976, and as it approaches its 50th anniversary, it's been undergoing some major renovations, which started back in 2019. Some of the new exhibits are open, but many are still being renovated. If you listen to those previous episodes, you will know that we were incredibly impressed with the galleries that are currently open and can't wait to get back when the whole building is finished.
So what we're about to present to you is a mashup of three different interviews with Dr. Teasel Muir Harmony, curator of the Apollo Collection, Dr. Jennifer Levasseur, curator of the Space Shuttle Collection, and Dr. Margaret Weidekamp, the Space History Department Chair and the curator of the Museum Social and Cultural History of Spaceflight Collection. Once the interviews were over, it was obvious that we'd covered some similar ground with all three, so we wanted to present those parts together in some way.
Yeah, I wanted to know more about what it was like to be a curator and also what we can expect going forward. We've not pieced together different interviews like this before, so hopefully I've done a good job with putting this together, and I hope it makes sense as well. So please let me know what you think.
That's
but let's
funny.
Crack on with this, shall we?
Time to shake off a case of the Thursdays and listen to Space and Things with Emily Carney and Dave Giles.
So let's start with Dr. Muir Harmony. Tell us about the renovations that are taking place at the National Air and Space Museum at the moment, and will the rest of it all be as good as the new Destination Moon exhibit?
Oh, well, I'm biased, so I probably shouldn't answer that question. The whole museum downtown will be open by July 2026. And so it's our anniversary, so that's part
nice.
Of it. And
okay.
then it's the Air and Space Museum opened on the bicentennial of the United States. And so this is also an anniversary for the country. And so we really do have a hard deadline, July 2026. For those not familiar, we're renovating the entire downtown location of the museum. And that includes updating the facility as well as all new exhibits.
And talking of the new exhibits, Dr. Weidekamp, which of them are you most excited about?
I'm excited about our visitors getting to see it. We're 8 out of 20 done, but we cannot face the psychological reality that 8 is not half of 20, and that we still have more of this project left to do than we've finished. But I will tell you that when we opened those 8 brand new, fresh, shiny galleries in October of 2022, part of what was so surprising to me is they're gorgeous. right? Yeah. It just came out so well. And we've been nose down an inch away from the paper, working on the details for years. And then to pick your head up and see people coming through the completed space and see what it's all turned into, to put all of those artifacts out in front of people, to let them interact with them, with our interactives, with each other. That's really an awful lot of fun. And I just think there's a neat moment of surprise, even for us who have been through those plans so many times, we see them in our sleep, to see what they look like when they're actually physically built and realized is just special.
Amazing. Do you ever just go down there and watch people enjoying the room to try and get feedback on what works, what doesn't work, and just for the own satisfaction of, yes, I knew that would work? Is that something that you all do as curators, or is that something that in my head I would do and no one else does?
Well, it's always such a pleasure to be in the exhibits. So in Destination Moon, we have some pretty
iconic,
stellar, iconic artifacts, right? Neil Armstrong's space suit, right? Obviously, that's a place where people are very excited and taking pictures, and I love to see that. But I get a big thrill of those other parts of the exhibit that I just don't know how visitors are going to interact with them, and whether they're going to take the time to read the labels and get excited. And I love seeing that. So some of the other types of artifacts, the ways that people are engaging with them and asking questions, and I can overhear conversations. And I, when I bring people through the exhibit, and then visitors will you know, come to me with extra questions and things, and it's really fun to engage with them. But I also get a fair amount of email too from people who visit.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and so some feedback there as well. It is really wonderful, after spending so many years working on something, to watch it be used is not quite the right word, but
enjoyed,
and to see how it's influencing the ways that people are thinking about spaceflight and lunar exploration, and introducing them to aspects of the history that they might not know. And it's a great opportunity to include more stories and approach the topic differently than we did in 1976. And I think that it's really sort of gratifying to see the ways that people are appreciating and engaging with that material.
I always think it's very funny, because whenever we shoot documentaries or things like that, the classic shot they want is the curator wandering around the gallery looking at things like we've never seen them before. And we always think, like, really? This is never, like, me hunched in front of a computer with six monitors going, that's my life. I will say, we as a curatorial staff have been off-site while the construction has been happening. And in some ways it has removed us from what used to be one of the rejuvenating things about being housed in the National Mall building, is in between meetings, on your way to lunch, or honestly, if you were just dragged down by that last meeting or some bit of bureaucratic paperwork, you'd go downstairs and spend 5-10 minutes walking around downstairs and reconnect with why you're here and what you're doing. And it really is a very special place to get to be. You see families who are absolutely making memories that they're going to have for a lifetime. You see families in absolute meltdown because it's 90 degrees out and it's August and they've been walking all day, and there's someone still determined that they're going to get all the way to the Washington Monument or all the way to the Capitol by the end of the day, and they're done. They need to get back to the hotel pool. But it is a really nice thing to be able to do that, and then to also just watch what people do with things. We build stuff and we have an idea about how visitors are going to use it. And most of the time our testing shows us what that's going to be. And then sometimes people interact with the space in a completely different way, and we end up going back and kind of rerouting where people are going to be walking or how things go, because they've just, visitors come in and see it in a different way. And that's, that kind of surprise is always funny. And there's an awful lot of knowledge on the floor, which is also fun. You'll hear these groups and they're talking about, oh yeah, your grandfather flew with this, or your grandmother worked on this thing. And so those stories are on our floor. So we're always aware when we're writing that we're both trying to educate and inform people who might not know anything about this, who might have gotten dragged along by somebody else and they don't care about this, but we're going to find something that they can be interested in, versus the people who built them and flew them and tested them and know every nut and bolt, and it has to stand up to that kind of scrutiny as well.
She's like, oh boy.
On the flip side of that, I know, having spoken to other people who are interested in spaceflight, when we're walking around space museums and we hear things being explained to people by other guests in the museum that some things aren't quite right. Is it difficult as a curator to bite your tongue in those situations?
Yeah, it's a little hard. I cannot deny it. It's a little tricky. I mean, if it's, you know, not so outlandish, if it's just like a minor detail, then that's, you know, it's not that big of a deal. And hopefully someone will have an opportunity to learn the accurate information at some point. It is a bit tricky.
Is there a museum policy on curators stepping in?
Intervening. the hope is that, you know, the material that we present is as accurate as possible. And I will say that, you know, we have had a few updates since we opened, and there are small things. So there's this, I can describe this one, which is a good example. So when President Kennedy proposed Project Apollo in 1961 before a joint session of Congress, there's this one photo that you'll see of him at a joint session of Congress. It's the one that gets used in circulation. It's not actually taken that day. So it's not actually, it is President Kennedy. It is a joint session of Congress. So that part's accurate, but it's not from that day. And that was a photo that got put in the exhibit initially. And so we replaced it with the one that is from that exact day. So that type of stuff where some things might slip, and that's not going to change the story that we're telling. It is, you know, on the wall, part of a larger description of that history, and the material there is specific to the day. But we really want to make sure every single thing in the exhibit is accurate. And so we've updated some of those things in the past year. And, you know, sometimes, you know, we have to make adjustments as well. So it's useful to get that feedback from people. Visitors will let me know. Sometimes we get experts in particular areas that say, actually, you might want to use this word, which is really helpful. And we'll edit and update as necessary.
Moving on to Dr. Lavasser and the space shuttle, how do you reconcile accessibility with the exhibit with preventing exhibits being damaged? Now, I'm sure we'd all love to get inside the spacecraft to look around, but that can't happen. How do you manage people's expectations with that?
We back up and think about accessibility in terms of allowing people of all different backgrounds to be able to learn about what our subject matter is. And so in the case of just a single artifact, it is a bummer that I can't let everybody walk up and touch it or go and climb around inside of it. But really, it's about equity. It's about you being able to see it being different than the experience someone in a wheelchair or who is blind or low sighted, what their experience would be. And there's something about my long-term commitment and duty to that object that means I don't think it's right. Even in the limited times that I have needed to get into the vehicle, those are so limited. It's because of the need to think about this in the long term. So I've said this a number of times when giving tours in the National Mall building is Neil Armstrong's suit is in a case specifically designed to preserve that object, probably the number one most important space history object ever, forever. Like, that's the terms I have to see this in. It's not because you're here to see it. It's not because my kids can come see it or their kids or their kids. It's because 500 years from now, I would like for it to be visible. I would like for it to be possible for somebody to see that and believe it really happened. And so I try not to damage it by not going into it or touching it. And I would also then, you know, sort of, you know, say it's not okay for you to do it. It's not okay for almost anybody to do it. We also think about the accessibility on the other side of it, which is there are things about spaceflight we all know because we all sit here on the ground. We may never understand or know. And so how can we convey those ideas? And so making it possible for you to maybe touch something or do an activity that someone in a wheelchair can also do has become a regular theme of most of our meetings that we're working on for these new exhibits we're developing. I will give one example because it was in my meeting this morning. We would like to convey Newton's third law because there is so much about a spacewalk and even just living in space that has to do with this principle of equal and opposite reaction. So when one is on an EVA, you can't just float and turn a crank or turn a wrench, or use a power tool that's going to put a bolt in place. It doesn't work that way in space. You have to secure your body to the ground, just like gravity secures us to the ground. But how do we do that for you and I is a little bit more straightforward than how a wheelchair person may do it. And so we have to spend way more time thinking through that than you would really imagine. And potentially, you know, creating a bigger space for something than maybe it would normally take. But we consider all that. And I really appreciate that's something that's, it's not uncommon in museums of today, but it has certainly been an expanded area of what we've done, even in just my career at the museum, is to think about how people come to understand our subject matter. So if it's encountering an artifact or encountering subject matter, it's about how can you get at that? And so this even gets into things like digital materials. So how much can I provide to you on our website or via a QR code or, you know, shortened URL or whatever it might be? Is I know that our audience is everything and anyone I can see and imagine. Therefore, what do I need to do to make it possible for basically anyone to get to that content? And so we spend a lot of time talking about digital content, what we're doing on our websites, so that people who can't get to Washington, D.C. or Chantilly, Virginia, would be able to learn more about space shuttle discovery, for example.
And one of the things I think that highlight that is, I think this was a COVID thing, but you did a tour of the inside. I think it was a COVID thing because I seem to remember that happening during COVID and on a few of the different artifacts where we was like, right, we got to do virtual museums because no one can get to the museum. But now you've got that resource, having gone in there to film it, it can now be used again, right? And stay on the website or even at the museum itself.
Yeah.
So that people, when they ask.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing that, I mean, we've been doing this for the 20 years that the Edward Verhaeghe Center has been open. We've been doing it with some kind of virtual presentation. And we do that in different forms. We did a big project with QTVR when it was the big thing to do. So we did a lot of 3D or, 3D photography or panoramic photography inside flight decks and cockpits of airplanes so that someone could walk up to a screen, pick something, and then they would be able to sort of have that experience. We've done it with, I know Enola Gay has an actual printed image where you can kind of look from left to right in the image and see how the pilot would have seen from left to right and inside the cockpit. So, and the same is true, and we've just done it in a much different way for Discovery, is that we've done, and we've done it for a few of our vehicles, we've done a lot of 3D scanning in recent years. And so the Wright Flyer is a great example of a 3D scan that was done by Smithsonian. And then curators jump in and kind of provide a sort of virtual tour in a sense where we create hotspots and mark out certain things that people should learn. There have been audio things recorded for that. And then more or less, it's just a lot easier, especially for me, to grab somebody that has a good video camera on staff and maybe find a way, if we're going to go in the space shuttle anyway, that we can just do a really great video tour we can put on YouTube. It's just a super straightforward way to do it. So there's like layers of complexity to how we can do that. It's just whatever's convenient. And during COVID especially, we used a lot of old and existing material because even for us, we were not allowed to come into the building. So we spent a lot of time kind of sifting through all of our resources and how could we kind of repurpose those or kind of reissue them in some way. We have docents that sit on a screen and we'll talk to people because So at least a few of our artifacts have it. Essentially, it's a standing Teams, Microsoft Teams meeting.
Amazing.
And anybody can just walk past the screen and that docent, if they're present, would be able to answer questions. That's a huge benefit for someone like me who fields a lot of questions via email. Since I'm a federal employee, anybody's, you know, welcome to look up my email. It's online. And so if I get a question, I'm always happy to answer the question. But if you're in the museum, how does somebody get a question answered? And those are, especially for the space shuttle, is just a huge benefit to have someone kind of permanently there. You don't have to stand or you're sitting in a really uncomfortable chair. You get to sit at home in your office and and do it that way. So if I had extra time, I'd be happy to sit there and talk to people that way. It's just not really in the cards right now.
Space is, I guess, a modern history. And this museum has all of it within it, which is quite something. Do you feel that the job is different as a result of that? Because especially with the way we're at that crossroads, I feel like, in society, where we're trying to make everything accessible for everyone. And spaceflight is a really good way of trying to encourage everyone to say, I can do whatever I want.
Yeah.
Even within my own capabilities, I can focus on lots of different things. But that perhaps if you're going to an Egyptian museum, you don't necessarily have that avenue to push that towards people.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly been the emergence of STEM education in the last, you know, handful of years, decade, couple of decades, where there's really been a push for that, which has a really strong component of, you know, encouraging more women, especially. I mean, I know when I was an undergraduate, women in science and engineering was becoming, there was a society for, you know, women in engineering. And so there was, you know, it was certainly emerging through my lifetime. And I think you're right that there's this, we've kind of hit a point where technology in particular has opened up the door for us to be able to do it. And because we are such a heavily technology-based museum in terms of our artifacts, it makes for a really good set of examples. And you can carry that way back into, you know, aviation in the 30s and 40s. And we use those examples when they're there. Bessie Coleman is always one of our key people. Amelia Earhart, any of those women who are sort of the early women aviators, kind of began to set the stage for some of the stories I tell about someone like Eileen Collins. Those are really important connections to be able to make for people, is that it doesn't necessarily really start. Our awareness comes of it in the last handful of decades. It's, you know, there wasn't the same awareness. There was a small segment of women who were aware that this needed, but the larger social awareness of technology's ability to open doors like that, I think, only comes when we, you know, certainly, you know, thinking about what you can do with your own cell phone and things like that, is just mobile technology really has just sort of exploded our awareness of, you know, what's possible out there. And so it also makes it, as a museum, the sort of conversely really challenging to keep up with all of that. Yeah. So how can we stay fresh? And I think anybody who visited the National Air and Space Museum in, say, the 80s or 90s would almost not recognize what's downstairs today. I hope they do, because not a whole lot, at least on the sort of infrastructure. It's more fresh and new and things like that. But the same ideas are still there in terms of how we go about our work and telling stories. The kinds of stories we're telling haven't shifted dramatically, but the way we tell them, the sort of details that we use, the examples that we draw on, have all really shifted, because we know that it's not the same people who are coming through the door in July of 1976 anymore. We have a huge international audience. Something like 20 to 30% of the people that come in the building are from other countries. So how do we appeal to that? How can we maintain relevance to young people who would, like my son, who would rather be playing Fortnite than hanging out with mom at the Air and Space Museum? I don't think that's necessarily true, but he's a good example of sort of kids today who may or may not engage with this stuff. And so how do we, like, what are those hooks? We talk a lot about sort of what's the big idea? What is the hook? What are the things that are going to attract viewers? You know, it's the same kinds of conversations that are had, except in a sort of very more, I would say, muted tone than a place like, say, Disney would have. And we've, you know, had this conversation internally, is, are we Disneyfying ourselves? Are we kind of making ourselves too much a sort of attraction that way, rather than being serious? And that's the thing, is you've got to have a little bit of both. We know our audiences like to touch screens, so we're going to have some screens that you touch. But we also know we have an audience of people who still like to actually put their hands on a thing and do it. So how do we then do that job? How do we represent the things that you really have to touch versus the things you can't touch at all? So how do we, you know, so how can we give you the experience of knowing what a space shuttle main engine is like without actually walking up and putting your hands all over something that will be damaged by your hands? You know, the oils from your hands will sit on that thing and eat away at it, you know, slowly over time. How can we prevent that? Well, we'll give you a really small version of it that you can then touch. But that also helps our low-sighted visitors be able to understand what that thing is. And so our ability to create those things, you know, is only recent. And so it makes our jobs very complex.
Here's a question for Dr. Muir Harmony. When we've been wandering around, we've noticed that there are many Apollo artifacts in the other galleries which aren't Apollo specific. For example, the Earthrise camera is in the One World Connected Gallery. So how difficult is it to navigate creating exhibits to help every curator get a piece of the different collections to help create a bigger picture?
It's a great question. And we just have the luck of having tons of very, very great artifacts. Mm. And so for an exhibit like Destination Moon, there's so many additional artifacts we would have loved to include in there. And so it is really lucky that there are other places to showcase Apollo artifacts, like at our Udvar-Hazy Center and also at museums across the country and across the world. And we can't fit everything into Destination Moon. We do coordinate quite a bit. And so I oversee the artifacts. It just so happens that I'm now the lead on Destination Moon and One World Connected. And so
okay.
I get to work in both of those exhibits and coordinate it. But we all try to work together. We have meetings. We have a lot of discussions. And each exhibit team has multiple representatives from the curatorial department as well as other departments. I will tell a little side story about that Apollo 8 camera.
Amazing.
It's part of the reason it's in One World Connected. That exhibit's all about how aerospace has transformed our understanding of Earth and our experience on Earth as well. We really wanted to tell that Earthrise story. It's so essential in that larger history. And we were going to have a camera from Apollo 8. Now, this is really Jennifer Levasseur's story to tell because she's the curator of cameras and astronaut photography and an expert in that field. And there was a whole lot of cameras from the Apollo collection. And we knew that some components were from Apollo 8, but it wasn't until she got her hands on them in the process of installing the exhibit, I believe, that she was able to determine that was the one that Bill Anders used to take the image. So we knew we were going to have an Apollo 8 camera in the exhibit, but we didn't know for sure it was the one that took Earthrise. So it was a really exciting, special
moment.
Yeah. It makes that exhibit also a must-see place if you are a fan of the Apollo program. You got to swing into One World Connected as well to check out that wonderful artifact.
Yeah, it's fun because I knew it was somewhere in the building and I assumed it would be in Destination Moon. So I walked around four times trying to find it. We'd seen the surveyor arm in the planet mm-hmm. the Surveyor 3 camera the day before. It's like, okay, let's try the other rooms. And I hadn't yet been in the One World room. And then I went in there and it's at the back and I was like, there it is. And it made so much sense to be there. But I think that's part of the fun. I could have just looked on my phone and Googled it, but I was like, no, I'm going to find it. It's part of the fun of being in the museum. And from doing that, I then was able to see a lot more and see things in detail. So yeah, it's fun going around, not knowing where things are, not knowing what you're going to see as you turn a corner. And I think we had that yesterday, didn't we? Many times when we were like, oh my God, I knew.
You turn around and you're like, that's that. And it's the real thing. Like, you know, it's not just like the replica, you know?
We knew that Gene Kranz's Apollo 13 waistcoat was there, but then you go up the stairs mm-hmm. and it's there and it was like,
there it is.
Oh my God. Yeah. I didn't know. There wasn't a signpost going this way to Gene Kranz's, which you don't want. It's part of that wonderful thing about being in a museum. And even when you know what's there and you can be excited about it beforehand, you've got that moment.
There's the popular stuff and deep cuts in there as well. I call them deep cuts. Things I'm like, ugh. But it's something obscure. You're like I saw Pioneer. This was in the Planets Gallery. Pioneer of Venus, a model. And I was like, I think I'm the only person who remembers this, but I'm excited it's here.
Yeah,
you know, because it's one of those things. Like that's a deep cut.
Absolutely.
And I'll just mention in the Planets Gallery, there's another Apollo related artifact. So the Surveyor 3 camera.
Yeah.
Having these artifacts in different exhibits a great way to emphasize that something like the Apollo program wasn't just this isolated program that didn't have a larger impact or wasn't part of a larger change in history. So it's so important to tell that story in One World Connected about how aerospace is transforming our experience on Earth and then also in the Planets Gallery because it's part of planetary exploration.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. So, Teasel, you alluded it to it earlier, and I'm sure anyone who's listening who has been to a space museum will have seen an item that has the words "on loan from the Smithsonian" written on a card underneath it. So I'm going to direct this one to Dr. Weitekamp as the chair of the Space History Department. As curators for the Smithsonian, how responsible are you for the items from your collections which are out on loan?
Oh, 100%. We are on top of those. We are interacting with the folks who are borrowing them. We're talking to the curators. We're inspired by their creative ideas about what they want to do with the artifacts. I've got a curator who is heading out on a trip, and two of the stops that have been added to that visit are stops at museums that have things on loan, one of which is going to be an issue in a year, one of which is having some issues right now. And so we're going to have somebody on the ground walking around, talking to their curators, walking through stuff. When we've brought new people on as chair of the Space History Department, one of the first things I'm doing is trying to get them out and about to see the things that are not here housed in the collection with the museum, but that are on loan, that are in Houston or at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center or in the Rocket Garden down at the Kennedy Space Center. So, yes, we divide the collection up topically, and we have a intellectual focus, and then we are in charge of the objects in that area. And I think that people don't always know every object has one curator in the end who is responsible for that, and we group those things topically. But it means that when you want to work on or move or display an object, you know who to call, and they are the final word on what happens with that. And they work with a big team of folks who understand rigging and conservation and collections care and just the logistics of keeping track of all of this stuff. But they are the content expert who are assigned to that object, probably hundreds, if not thousands of objects. But we keep in touch with all of them.
Yeah, the thing that has been going through my head a lot as I've been talking to all of you is the role of curator is so much bigger than I imagined. Because not only you think curator, you think, okay, well, that's...
You think we wander around the gallery staring at things we've already built.
That's what I learned from the documentaries.
Yeah, from the documentaries, yeah. You guys just walk around. Like you're seeing it for the first time.
We
and
do.
I'm like, no, yeah.
I love that. But you've got... Okay, yes, you're building an exhibit. That's maybe job 10. The two jobs which I think are probably the most important, which we've not talked about with anyone, is restoration and conservation. How much does the role of curator actually deal with those two things? Or is that a separate department of the Smithsonian where that's poking the curator going, by the way, this artifact's been out for too long? Or who's in charge of that kind of decision? Say, for example, an old book that might only want exposure to light for so long.
The wonderful thing about being at the Smithsonian is we have the luxury of being so specialized. So being a very large and powerful museum complex means that we have a conservation department. We have a CPU, a collections processing unit, and that means somebody's keeping track of where is each thing. If it breaks down into components and they need to be stored in different conditions, the different components, how do we keep track of all of that? We've got a registrar's department that just does the cataloging. And the paperwork and keeping in touch with the donors and keeping in touch with the loaned objects and the borrowers. So the curator in some ways really works at the nexus of all of that in those interactions. And most of us are trained as academics primarily. So we started and trained to be college professors to teach. And instead we picked this job where instead of 35 students for 15 weeks, we're going to do a million people through a gallery for 25 minutes, but they're voluntarily here and they want to do something. And the work then is also much more collaborative. Everything that we do is on a team. So the curator is really an important part of all of those teams. So somebody is keeping track of how much light exposure things can get. You get experience over time, most of the time, not through making mistakes, but occasionally by making mistakes. And learning about various conditions that objects can be under. And where the curator really brings in the specialized knowledge is being able to say, oh yeah, that was built in this place, or that piece comes off, or here's what the history of this thing is, and that's why this is formed the way that it is. And that then informs the conservator who might look at a thing and really know everything about the chemistry of the paint and the metal and the plastics. But you're the one who can tell them this is how that all comes together in that object, and therefore this is what I want the treatment to look like. But they're also really schooling us on it's not supposed to look super shiny like it just came off the assembly line. It's supposed to look, you want to preserve the fact that it was used for years. You want to preserve those visible signs of ownership and use. and that provenance. So that's part of what's fun. On the exhibit building, we're thinking, you know, here are the stories we want to tell. This is what the scholarship is telling us about what's important about the shuttle program, the Apollo program, planetary exploration. And then we're saying, you know, okay, what are the things that would allow us to show it, not tell it, right? Nobody wants to come to this museum and read my book on the wall. You can just buy my book.
Yeah.
We want to show you.
Yeah.
Highly recommend.
A long caption. But I get what you say.
People don't read long stuff. No, and you want them to see something and engage with it. So, for instance, we can put on display downstairs, we've got a UMO jet engine, one of the very first jet engines ever built. It has a pull string on it. You can start it the way you would start your lawnmower, right? With a But if we can point that out to people, say, like, notice that ring that looks a lot like what you have on your lawnmower? Yeah, that jet engine has a pull string, and given an era when you might have stood in front of a propeller and physically spun it in order to get the motor started, that's not a completely ridiculous thing the way that it is to a modern sensibility. But if I can get you to look at that again, that might be something that you remember. And so that's part of what the curator is doing, is trying to bring in those kinds of details, that history, that context, to say, okay, that's not actually a completely stupid technological idea in that moment. It's one that's very antiquated now, but let me explain to you why we have it, and let me figure out how I write in just 30 words something that's going to get you to look up from the label back at the object and make that discovery. Things we find that if we write long labels, and here's my very long answer, what people come out with is some sense that, like, boy, those people at the Smithsonian know a lot.
Yeah.
And they say, like, about what? Whoa, they do a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
But if I can get you to look up and notice that thing, to think about what's it like to be in a lunar module that's wrapped in foil, because that's enough protection and it's exactly enough, not too much and not too heavy, then that's something that you take home and you actually remember, as opposed to every fact and figure that I can put on a label. So that's part of what the curators do, is we think of ourselves as storytellers. We have a strong connection to our education background and our current engagement with scholarship as we're continuing to research and write books. And we're trying to kind of package that in a three-dimensional space for our visitors.
Just a vehicle for space memes. It's Space and Things with Emily Carney and Dave Giles.
So that concludes the interviews which we recorded while we were in Washington, D.C. I wasn't expecting to get four episodes out of three interviews, but the process of being in a room together and having just explored what they had been working on generated more questions than if we had just been sitting on Zoom doing our interviews like we normally do. I really loved the process, and I hope that you as a listener feel that it was worth Emily and I traveling all that way. Anyway, the Smithsonian is a special place with special people, and I know we've spoken about this over the last few weeks, but when the whole of that downtown Washington DC museum reopens, if the eight galleries that have already been reopened are anything to go by, it's going to be the best museum in the world. And it should be with the items it has, but that isn't a given. Do you agree with that assessment, Emily?
Oh, yeah. I've said this a few times. I was absolutely blown away. Even though most of the downtown Air and Space Museum, a lot of it is still closed because of the renovations, the parts that were open, I was absolutely just blown away. I mean, speechless.
We weren't disappointed, were
no.
we? That's the thing. Like, if that was all it was ever going to be, it would still be amazing.
It would still be great. It was absolutely, like, Dave can attest to this. There were parts of the museum where I was absolutely, like, gone. I was on another planet. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, I can't believe this is something that's even here. You know, stuff that I've written about that, you know, you conceptually can visualize, but then you see it and you're like, holy crap, that's that. I think I can speak for Dave when I say this. I'm very grateful we got the opportunity to see the museum and talk the curators. I mean, it just was an amazing experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One thing that has been announced since we got back is that the Artemis 1 spacecraft, which flew around the moon in 2022, is going to be on display at the Smithsonian as part of one of the renovated galleries. these museums are just continuing to grow and get more and more amazing, amazing things. My understanding is we're going to have the Boeing Milestones of Flight Hall, which is going to be where the main entrance used to be. Then there's going to be an exhibit called At Home in Space, which will replace the Moving Beyond Earth Gallery. And some of these are going to start opening from 2026. Now, NASA are loaning the Orion spacecraft to the Smithsonian. And then it's things like that which make, I mean, obviously they've got all the Apollo stuff, all the shuttle stuff, all the Gemini, all the Mercury. All, they own it all. They've got it all and they loan it out to everyone else. And that to me is what makes this museum so special. That, and it's such a great thing to have one institution in charge of the, of looking after it and distributing all of that stuff. I think it's a really great thing that you guys have done over there. But yeah, these museums are amazing. And the role of a curator is just special, isn't it? I mean, yeah, Emily, if you could be a curator of any collection within the Smithsonian collection, what do you think you would like to be?
Oh gosh, it would probably be a ton of hard work. If they had a collection like this, I would love to curate it, just space stations. And people are going to be like, oh yeah, it's because of Skylab. Not necessarily. I mean, there have been Soviet space stations, there's been the ISS, there are plans for commercial space stations coming up. You know, I think it's important to talk about, okay, how do we live in space for longer periods of time? So if I had a choice of things I could curate, it would be something like that, because I just love the topic. I like the artifacts that I've seen. To me, it's just an incredible topic, and it has a lot of relevance, I think, for the future as well. What would you curate, Dave?
Spacesuits. Definitely spacesuits.
Yes. Yeah, I figured that's, but you would be awesome at that. That's awesome.
But we're going to, in a few weeks, we are going to talk to someone who, at the Smithsonian, who is in charge of the renovation and preservation of spacesuits. And that's going to be really insightful. We met Lisa Young while we were there, and it's fascinating what they're up to. So we've got that to look forward to as well. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the interviews we did while we were there in January. Hopefully in the future we'll be able to do more away days and trips. Obviously it's hard because I'm in the UK and Emily's in Florida, so finding times for us to be able to, and the money to be able to get everywhere is obviously difficult, but that was the first time we've done it and it was amazing. I think the four episodes we got out of that experience was amazing. But also personally, I thought it was a really wonderful experience to have with you, Emily, and actually to be there and enjoy each other's company around these amazing artifacts was such a huge thing for the two of us, I feel.
Yeah, I think it was a good bonding experience for us, obviously, because like Dave said, you know, we are on opposite sides of the ocean. We've always gotten along well, but it's kind of a challenge. When we first started the show in 2020, we didn't really know each other. We didn't know if it would work at all. Thankfully, it did. But it's cool to have these opportunities to sort of meet up with each other and just enjoy, you know, just kind of enjoy each other's company and see these cool artifacts as well. So it was a really cool experience. And it's my hope that we get to do more of these kinds of things in the future. Maybe once a year. Who knows?
Oh, that'd be great.
So,
yeah, absolutely.
That would be great, you know, so it would be wonderful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So if you're on our Patreon page, you may have already heard these interviews today because we put up each unedited video as we published the first part of the interviews after their respective episodes came out. So there's no new unseen content for you this week, but plenty of fun things to look forward to and for you to submit questions for us to ask. If you're not signed up or you've signed up recently, you can, of course, go back and see any of the unedited videos from any interview since we started doing this. And if you can't be bothered to scroll through everything, just drop me a message with the one you want to see and I'll send it over to you. Anyone who's not part of our Patreon page can do so by heading to patreon.com/spaceandthings.
Better than eating broccoli, it's Space and Things with Emily Carney and Dave Giles.
So, Emily, what has caught your eye in spaceflight this week?
Well, there is an article that came out a few days ago from, this is actually in Business Insider. It is about the moon Europa. It's a moon of Jupiter. If you're wondering, obviously, if you've seen the movie 2010, The Year We Make Contact, it plays kind of a little part in the film. But the moon Europa was previously believed to probably be one of the only places in the solar system to maybe support life. And it has been found by the Juno spacecraft that Europa produces 1,000 tons of oxygen every 24 hours. NASA has reported that would keep 1 million people alive for the day. And these were published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature Astronomy. So, unfortunately, this estimate is a little less than that. A million sounds like a lot, right? But it really isn't, because, like I said, it would only keep people alive for about a day or so, which you kind of need more oxygen than that. Yeah. If you want to stay alive for, you kind of need more than that. This is a really fascinating report for me, because I've always been curious about kind of the composition of Europa. It's theorized that it has underground oceans, that it has sort of a icy water system in it. I also wanted to mention, within 6 months, the launch target of a new spacecraft called the Europa Clipper. It is supposed to launch, I believe, from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, if I'm not mistaken, but it's supposed to launch on October 10th. Like I've said many times before, spacecraft get delayed for multitudes of reasons, so I don't know if that's a locked-in launch date, but hopefully between Juno, which has been orbiting Jupiter since 2016, and Europa Clipper, we're going to find some more things about the mysterious moon of Jupiter that might have a water ocean in it. We don't know, or ice, an ocean under ice. We not really sure yet. I think the moons of Jupiter are, to me, among the most fascinating in the solar system, because you have Ganymede, you have Io, which has a volcanoes on it, which to me is crazy. And you have Europa, which of course is it's theorized that it may be one of the only places that could support life, possibly. But this report is basically saying it may not support as much life as we previously thought. So anyway, I thought that was just fascinating. I have a little soft spot for planetary science, so I thought that was really cool. So, Dave, what has caught your eye this week?
Yeah, I haven't been following anything, but I had a quick scan just now, and it looks like we might have a new Starship launch soon, which is obviously always fun. It's saying, according to space.com, it could be as soon as Thursday the 14th of March, which is the day this podcast come out, which would be fun. But there's a headline here. I've not even opened the article, but here's a headline. Private Varda space capsule returns to Earth with space-grown antiviral drug on board.
Okay, that's awesome.
Isn't that crazy? Like, just that headline alone makes me go, this is the time we're living in.
That's good, though. That's something good.
Yeah, exactly. Stuff that you have no idea they're doing in space, they are doing in space. And so, of course, along with Emily's article, I will put the links to that article in our show notes, because I think that one is one I'm definitely about to click on to read once Emily and I press stop.
Yeah.
Because that is fun.
Yeah. We need stuff like that on Earth.
Exactly.
Especially after this cold and flu season.
Yeah, right? God.
We need this.
You and I have both been hit numerous times over the last 12 months, right?
Yeah.
And both of us are normally historically fairly...
robust.
We're both fairly robust. Thank you. That's absolutely blowing my mind that they're doing that. I love it. Anyway, if you want to find our show notes, you can look in at the description of this episode in your podcast provider, or just head straight over to spaceandthingspodcast.com, where there is a full archive of every episode and their show notes that we've put out. All 185. Oof, crazy.
Where mispronunciation is entertainment. It's Space and Things.
That's it for this week. Thank you for joining us once again. Hopefully you've enjoyed this episode, and please keep getting in touch with your thoughts and leave some reviews and ratings on your podcast platform.
A big thanks to our Patreon subscribers for their continued support. Please head over to patreon.com/spaceandthings if you want to be a part of it. But don't forget, in space, no one can hear you me.
Things in space, space and things. Okay.